Welcome to Off Topic. I'm Steve Hayward.
I'm Kathy Jaffray. It's summer, it's hot, and we're talking about the movies. Saturday night at the movies. Who
cares what picture you see? This is the Off Topic Movies on the Radio episode. And the truth is, it's not my idea to do this, is it?
It's not mine either.
It's in fact the idea of frequent Off Topic contributor, playwright, essayist, Idris Goodwin. Idris, welcome to the show.
Good to be here, y'all.
What made you want to do movies on the radio?
Every time the summer comes around, I get this wonderful romantic feeling in my chest of what's going to come out, what's going to flop, because inevitably something flops, and what's going to be the little movie that comes out in like early August that we hear about later around Oscar season. So I've always loved this time of year. When I was a little bitty baby boy, I grew up going to classic 80s George Lucas, Steven Spielberg, Robert Zemeckis, wonderful, magical experiences.
For me, it was Star Wars was my movie, and I think that had to do with the way that it spoke to me. The specific story of Luke Skywalker, kind of in a nowhere planet.
Take these two over to the garage, will you? I want them cleaned up for dinner.
But I was going into Tosche Station to pick up some power converters.
You can waste time with your friends when your chores are done.
Really directionless, doing things with droids. It turns out he's the savior of the universe. when I was 6 or 7 when Star Wars came out, I thought, That's exactly what's going to happen to me.
My jam back in the day was definitely Back to the Future.
Oh, yeah?
And that one has stood the test. There are movies I go back to now where I'm like, ooh, Teen Wolf, really? But Back to the Future continues to be my jam. Marty McFly is just a cool dude, man. Tell me, doctor, where are we
going this time? I wonder what kids today are watching. I wonder what the new Back to the Future is.
I'm Isaac and I'm 11.
I'm Nathan, I'm 9.
I'm Abby and I'm 10.
This summer we've seen Grown Ups 2, Pacific Rim,
A Zombie Invasion,
Zombie Apocalypse.
Yeah.
Mostly Apocalypse, not Invasion. Well, yeah, you could say that. First it was Invasion, then Apocalypse.
How do you know? You've never seen it.
I've seen the previews, Nathan.
Yeah, no, you've seen the whole thing.
I've seen like a freaking wave
shut
of zombies.
Up. Just shut up. First, they were going out to the city, and then the zombie invasion started.
Well, no, then a police guy got ran over by a truck. He's like, BAM!
You know, the zombie was riding it.
No, really?
Yes, he was.
Zombie in a truck?
Yeah, he was going.
How do you know?
Because I seen the movie.
You see, it's like the opposite of space. It's like, well, usually some people think that aliens are from space. Really, these aliens are from a different dimension, underwater.
This guy named Drew, he owned all these little minions. He calls them minions.
Yellow minions.
Yeah. They don't speak English. I don't know what they're speaking.
Yeah, and
like baby language.
And The Sick Woman 2 is basically about this guy who stole something from Antarctica.
And his name is El Macho.
Can I talk, please?
That's not what happened at all.
Well, I don't want to spoil all of the parts.
Yeah, apparently none of the... You're not making a bit of sense. I'm just going to be honest. I don't think we're really good at talking in the radio. I don't think we're really that good. I'm just saying, I'm being honest.
Lone Ranger. I wanted to watch it.
People think it looks good, but then at the end, they're like, oh my god, this sucks.
Like Monsters University.
It kind of sucked, okay?
It was sucked a lot.
We've been talking about movies that are great and magical and wonderful, but not every movie is great and magical and wonderful.
That's right. And when you think about the summer blockbuster, there's an element of it, of the blockbuster, of the idea of the blockbuster, which is just flying just a little too close to the sun, which means that when it comes to a blockbuster, it's not just a question of whether it's successful or not. It's whether it's an amazing success or a flop. How bad, Idris, does a movie have to be in order to be a flop?
One of the wonderful things about the summer blockbuster season is no one can ever anticipate what the flop is going to be. And it's I love it because it shows the you know, that Hollywood, as much as, you know, for all of their resources, all of their money, all their gravitas, they can never predict the winning horse.
What the flop is about the mystery of success. It's about the mystery of filmic immortality, in that it is not about measurements, it's not about metrics, it's not about formula.
So there's an enormous cost to betting wrong, right, because these movies are so expensive to make. Mm-hmm.
George Lucas and Steven Spielberg, who are the architects of the summer blockbuster movie season, you know, movies like Jaws and Star Wars, pretty much are the reason why we why studios cart out these big special effects laden movies every summer. They recently went to the University of Southern California, which is, you know, the place you go. It is the top of the mountain where you learn kung fu.
Right.
If you
right.
want to beat the masters or be the masters.
The movies,
that's
yeah.
right. And basically they were saying that the way that movie distribution has changed so much, and the way theaters are changing, and the way the public is now has more options for viewing films, that flops will that no studio can recover from a flop, and that there are going to be three or four more flops in the coming years that are pretty much going to destroy the movie business as we know it.
There's going to be eventually be an implosion or a big meltdown. There's going to be an implosion where three or four, maybe even a half a dozen of these mega budgeted movies are going to go crashing into the ground, and that's going to change the paradigm again.
And then what does the world look like after that?
Well, it'd like 2008. It's we will come back from it. That's what I mean.
But
you're going to end up with is fewer theaters, bigger theaters, with a lot of nice things. Going to the movies, it's going to cost you $50, maybe $100, maybe $150.
Like Broadway costs today.
Yeah, it's like Broadway or going to a football game.
Saturday night at the movies. Who cares what picture you see?
So we talked to Dr. Kim Walker at the University of Colorado at Colorado Springs about his thoughts about the way the movie paradigm has shifted, how the industry is changing, and how movies are made differently today.
I think we're moving away from people's inclination to want to go out to the theater to watch a blockbuster film. I think you are seeing a kind of, and have been since the studio system dissolved, an effort to make films that are more for adult populations. Back in the studio system, everything was considered to be sort of rated G, even though there was no rating system. It was intended to be fit for everyone because of the code. The Hays Code was derived from the Catholic Legion for Decency, and it said that no films that came out of the Hollywood system could be sympathetic to wrongdoing, evil, or sin. So if there was a narrative created in Hollywood, and in that narrative someone committed a crime, they would have to receive some type of moral restitution by the end of the film. And that system was in place really well into the 1960s, and it had disintegrated in terms of power and came to its end right around the same time a lot of America's upcoming directors were coming out of film school, the Coppolas, the Scorseses, the movie brats, as they're known. It dissolved at a good time. De Palma made films that were certainly edgy and Scorsese in terms of violence. Lucas and Spielberg were thought to be coming out of the West Coast, so they were kind of still trying to do films that appeal to mass audiences, mass tastes. It was thought that the film schools on the East Coast, particularly NYU, were trying to instill in their filmmakers auteurism, the notion of making personal films about subjects that interested them and were original to them. So, I think Lucas and Spielberg, while they're part of that era, were still attached to the sort of old model of creating blockbusters. You know, I was surprised to hear Spielberg and Lucas complaining that they can't get their films distributed, apparently, by the studio system.
But it's just, you can't, I mean, like now, I'm going into, making my own personal films, but I know I can't release them. This is why. Well, because if I make a movie for $1 million, it's still going to cost me $10 or $15 million
to market it.
To market it.
Yeah.
I'm not going to spend 15. I know I'm going to lose money at it because nobody's going to want to see the movie anyway. So why would I spend another $15 million? The issue is that you're going to be able to make these movies, and eventually, you know, you can put them on the internet or anything, but you're not going to make any money at it. So you know, the monetizing issue is still a big deal, and you have to be able to see where your market is.
For 20 years, the argument has been, oh, the technology is going to make it available to put these tools in the hands of independent directors, producers, writers, so that they can enjoy the hyphenate of writing, producing, directing, and those people still have to find an audience. Now, it's true that with video on demand and what have you, it seems like the channels are opened up for distribution and exhibition. I don't think there's much question about that. I can get on Creative Space. I can create a feature-length film that may be interesting to a community of people who are interested in, wrongful convictions in the prison system. But I've still got to find an audience of those people willing to pay to download that film. I would have probably been better served to get that film adopted through a film festival and somebody else agree to do the distribution and exhibition of that picture. It's unlikely, I say this only because I've experienced it, that one person, one auteur, can take from soup to nuts that idea and find it, go through the system, come out on the other side, and find an audience. It's the reason that some of the people back in the studio system, a director of photography would have on his filmography 120 films, 160 films. Those people could make more films in a year than the typical, or what is now the emerging auteur, could make in a lifetime, just because of the apparatus and how efficient and effective that production model had become. Yeah, we have some of the tools that they had. I guess you heard the story about Patton Oswalt. He stood up in front of a audience of comedians with his iPhone, and he said, "You now have in this device all the technology Orson Welles used to create Citizen Kane." And I found that just absurd. Maybe you have a tool that will record a performance, but to say you have the talent to put behind an iPhone to create Citizen Kane because you own an iPhone, that's absurd.
That was Dr. Kim Walker, who teaches film at the University of Colorado at Colorado Springs. Welcome back to Off Topic. I'm Kathy Jaffray.
This is Idris Goodwin.
And you know, we're talking about when you came up in the 90s, it really was kind of a golden age for independent film.
The 90s were a magical, wonderful, inspirational time if you were someone who aspired to make movies, because that was the time where there was case study after case study of just regular people, you know, average Joes and Josephines who were maxing out credit cards, who were scraping together cash and making movies with, you know, digital video cameras and 16 millimeter. And they were going to places like the Sundance Film Festival,
right,
and the Telluride Film Festival. And these people were winning Oscars in some cases.
Right. So, tell me who you love. Tell me who you love from those days.
Well, of course, I had admiration for the Steven Soderberghs.
Oh, yeah.
Whose Sex, Lies, and Videotape,
right,
was one of the ones that kind of kicked things off. You had... of course, you had Kevin Smith, who made Clerks.
Great movie.
You had Quentin Tarantino, of course, with the Reservoir Dogs and Pulp Fiction. You know, what was really special about that era, and I think it's different from where we're at now, is that most of these folks had the storytelling acumen first.
Mm-hmm.
But what we didn't have was uncles in the business. We didn't have access to capital. And then suddenly the technology started becoming more accessible.
So there are these two different parts. There's the technology. That's one half of it. But the other half of it is storytelling. And that's something that you can have all the technology in the world. If you don't have the storytelling ability, if you don't have those skills, your movie's going to be terrible.
had the opportunity to speak to a really good friend of mine named Scott Teams. Scott Teams is the writer-director of an award-winning, critically acclaimed smaller drama called That Evening Sun, which stars, you know, Hal Holbrook, who was into Into the Wild, and Walton Goggins, who's the star of the TV show Justified, and he's also been on the show The Shield. And so he's, you know, he's worked with Hollywood actors. He's gone to Sundance and other places like that. We spoke to Scott about what it takes to succeed in Hollywood.
I discovered, I suppose, pretty early on, unfortunately, that the writing is what makes or breaks your movie. And that's, digital technology has no bearing on that. And so people think because they can make a movie, they should make a movie. That's not the case, but yeah, they do it anyways. The quality is getting worse and worse. It's getting more watered down. There's a million people out here who can make pretty pictures. I mean, literally, a million people out here who can shoot camera, focus it, light it well. But there's not a lot of people that can write well. And so I chose to focus on writing. And so what I've done is kind of try to carve a career writing bigger movies to pay my bills while trying to make and direct my little movies that I don't expect to make money. And because I'm able to, you know, make a living writing for other people, that means my movies don't have to make money. I mean, I just want to make them, you know. It's kind of the John Sayles model. You know, he's kind of my hero in terms of career path. He writes a lot for studios, assignment work and rewrites and ghostwriting and adaptations or whatever. And then he goes and makes his little movies that nobody cares to go see, and but they don't have to because he, you know, he's a $1 million writer, so he gets $1 million or whatever to write a script. And he can pay his bills. And then he can make his movies. He invests a lot of his own money in his own movies. He puts his money where his mouth is.
Is there any of these big movies, these bigger movies that you doctor up? Is there where can we see your handiwork? Is there a particular Netflix scene we can go to and be like, that's all Scott Teams, clean that one up?
My first studio movie is shooting this fall, so it's not out yet. I hope it'll be out next year. And that's the thing about writing is, like, you know, you write these things and they can pay your bills. The frustrating thing is, it's so hard to get a big studio movie made that they develop for every, God, I don't know, for every, who knows, 20, 25, 30 more, like, scripts that are developed at studio level, you know, maybe one of those, two of those get made. I mean, I really care about the work I'm doing, but I'm not directing. It's not as much of an emotional attachment. I can kind of just do it, let it go, and move on and hope. Hey, if it gets made, awesome. Even better, if it doesn't, I haven't attached myself too deeply to it. What I really care about are my little movies that I'm trying to get made, so that gives me another passion to pursue, but it's best when you can kind of not get too attached to the bigger stuff because it has a hard time getting made, just like the little stuff does. So.
So here's my big question. I'm sure you heard about the Spielberg-Lucas thing. Like, they went to USC, and you know, these are guys who were, like, made billions of dollars in the film industry, you know, kind of in many ways the architects of our childhood, you know, viewing choices. You know, and they're saying it's going to implode. You know, they're presenting this sort of cynical, somewhat cynical view. And I'm wondering what your take on that is, as you know, someone who grew up on these guys' movies and someone who's out feeding his family doing this work.
I think there's a bit of a disconnect. I'm not saying what they're saying isn't true. There's truth to it. I mean, I don't think the film war is going to implode, but I have to not think that way. I mean, I can't afford to think anything but that way. I mean, you know what I mean? Like, it doesn't. I have to think that everything's okay. You know what I mean? Because otherwise, I'm kind of dead in the water. I have to believe that. But I think that what Ross is talking about here is it's filmmaking on such a different level. Steven Soderbergh talks about one of the reasons he wanted to leave the industry because he couldn't get his movies made. He couldn't get quote-unquote, like, low-budget movies made. Now, low-budget to Steven Soderbergh is $30 million, $20 million. You know, that's like not low budget movie. I hate to break the news to him, but it's, you know what I mean? Like, if those guys, Steven Spielberg and Soderbergh and George Lucas, if those guys could make movies for $5 million, they can make any movie they want, anytime they want, as long as they want. Like, they have that power. It's a guarantee. But those guys don't know how to do movies at that level. And $5 million is a lot of money to make a movie. Like, you can make a really nice movie for that amount of money. And frankly, I mean, if we're talking about, like, $250 million movies are going to implode and shouldn't get made anymore, I would agree with that. I mean, I would say that's a good thing, you know? Like,
yeah.
God, I mean, like, that is, there's so much waste involved at that level of filmmaking. It's like the amount of money wasted is extraordinary. I mean, there's no movie in the world that should cost $250 million. It's just insane. That's insane. It's crazy. It's really crazy. But, and that's not to say if those movies go away, maybe it all goes away, because in many ways, those are the things that hold everything up, because they may cost that much money, but they also make the most money. So they support the industry in a large way. It's hard to say. I don't know. But I just, all I know is that I can't think about that. I can't, you know, like, all I can do is control the work. I can't control any of that, you know? I can't control any of that, so I can't worry about it. All I can control is the work I do and the quality of the work that I do. And so I focus on that. I focus on the things that I can control.
That was writer-director Scott Teams. This is Off Topic.
As he usually did during the summer, Professor Stillman took a group of college students to London. It was one of those newfangled, experiential courses that Colorado College offered routinely, the kind that had not existed, had not even been considered a remote possibility, back when he had been an undergraduate at the University of Toronto. The introduction to Shakespeare class he had taken had been conducted in a windowless room by a bald man who stared at you if you asked a question. For his students, an introduction to Shakespeare class meant going to England itself, walking the same streets Shakespeare had walked, seeing the same ancient buildings, staring up in wonder at the vaulted ceilings in Westminster Abbey, just as the bard himself must have done 400 years earlier. "Would you take shelter here in the event of a zombie apocalypse?" he overheard one of his students ask. They were in the front end of Westminster, and the student happened to be standing on the stone that marked the burial place of Charles Darwin, steps away from where Isaac Newton had been entombed. "Totally not," replied the other student. "Look at those stained glass windows. If you think they're going to hold back scores of the undead, you're making a serious mistake." "That's the thing about a zombie apocalypse," remarked the first student. "If it breaks out, there's, like, no good place. Zombies will be everywhere, including here." "If the zombie apocalypse does happen, you have my permission to eat my brains," said the second student. "And you have my permission to eat mine," affirmed the first. Professor Stillman could not restrain himself. "Excuse me," he said. "You are steps away from the tomb of Richard II, and over there is Charles Dickens. How is it that he can even think about zombies in a place like this?" For a moment, the students looked back at him guiltily. Then one of them said, almost apologetically, "Well, we just saw World War Z." "It's a movie," explained the second student. "I know it's a movie," said Stillman, somewhat petulantly, though the truth was he didn't actually know anything about it. "Movies," he snorted, and was about to say more, but didn't. "Movies," he felt like saying, "they were the problem. Movies were the hill the Shakespearean scholar, the novelist, the poet had to climb. Movies were the wall anyone who trafficked in the printed word had to scale with his bare hands. Movies were the shape of the new amnesia. Movies were the end of the world, the gradual withering of culture into the shapeless husk of a zombie movie starring the grinning Brad Pitt." "It's a zombie movie," said the first student, "but it isn't just any zombie movie. It's like the end of zombie movies." "He's right," said the second student. "World War Z is like this zombie movie that comes in and eats the brains of all the zombie movies that came before it. You come out of it and you see that the world is, like, still existing, that, like, civilization itself hasn't been overrun by undead hordes, and you're, like, so relieved." It's true, affirmed the second student. Once you see it, you can't stop thinking about zombies. You can try. I mean, you can go to some place that has nothing to do with zombies, and then all of a sudden, your brain starts to do it. You think, what if that guy buying a cheeseburger next to me in McDonald's, what if he's a zombie? What if all these people are zombies? It will seriously freak you out. I doubt that very much, said Stillman, who took great pride in being unfreakoutable. You would totally be into it, said the student. Even you. Stillman fixed the student with his gaze. And what's that supposed to mean, even me? Nothing, replied the student. It's just you're not a movie guy, exactly. I am a student of the cinema, asserted Stillman. But even as he said this, he found himself wondering if it was still true. Sure, he had seen all of Fellini and sat through most of Bergman. But could you still call yourself a moviegoer if you never went to the movies? And so that night after class was finished and the students were all safely back in their hotel for the night, he found himself standing in line for the midnight showing of World War Z. He bought his ticket and passed by the snack bar. He got a medium popcorn and a Coke and made his way into what turned out to be a crowded theater. He couldn't remember the last time he'd done this, the last time he'd allowed himself to be sealed up in darkness with a group of others, enclosed in a movie. I'm so psyched for this, he heard a voice behind him say. Without quite meaning to, and without being able to stop himself, Stillman realized that he was psyched. He was eating popcorn and already a little freaked out. And then the movie started, World War Z. It was a zombie movie, and like all zombie movies, it began the same way. There is the normality of everyday existence. An ordinary family is talking in the car, playing one of those games that all families play.
No.
Does it live on
but then a motorcycle zips by, tearing the mirror from the side of the car.
Hey!
It was a small and jarring thing. Stillman felt his teeth clench. There was something horrifying and tiny about the sound, the metal-on-metal clank. It said, very quietly and in the special language of movies, that a future with zombies lay around the corner, and that it would not go well. Stillman stayed until the end and got back to the hotel before the students even knew he was gone. He couldn't tell if he was freaked out or not. The next day, just to make sure, Stillman went back to Westminster Abbey to see if he could make himself not think of zombies. But it was impossible. He watched the tourists walk in that directionless and lumbering gait of theirs, with blank, uncomprehending looks on their faces, staring up at the ceiling. Almost, but not quite, undead. No need for a zombie apocalypse, Stillman found himself thinking. They're here already.
Welcome back to Off Topic. I'm Kathy Jaffray.
I'm Steve Hayward.
And I'm Idris Goodwin.
We're talking about films in the summertime, movies on the radio.
Movies on the radio.
Movies on the radio.
I wonder if movies are different on the radio than they are anywhere else, because you can get movies everywhere now, right?
Movies are, you can get them on your phone, you can have them beamed into your glasses. Pretty soon they're just going to be playing directly onto your retinas.
Are you having movies beamed into your glasses actually right now?
Not at the moment.
one of the questions is there still something specific? Is there still, what is that thing that happens in a movie theater?
If the film business is going to implode, if there will be no more summer blockbuster seasons, if we're all just going to have our own little personal movies, like our own little personal novels, will we still be able to go see movies as a community together? Will we still gather and sit in a room together with people grumbling and coughing and phones going off to watch a movie?
So this is where someone like Jim Turner comes in. Jim Turner is the president of the Independent Film Society of Colorado and the founder of the Indie Spirit Film Festival that's been going in Colorado for the past 6 years. And what the Indie Spirit Film Festival and other festivals like that do is bring together filmmakers and audiences outside of that traditional mainstream market mechanism.
I'm Jim Turner. I'm the founder and president of the Independent Film Society of Colorado. We put on the annual Indie Spirit Film Festival every year. Like most people, I've always liked film. One year I decided to go to Sundance, so I went to their website and I saw a little link that said volunteer. So I clicked on that and the head openings. I volunteered at the Sundance Film Festival, spent 2 weeks there, had the time of my life, and thought, hey, we need something like this in Colorado Springs. We won't be Sundance, but we sure could have a good time and show a lot of good films to people. When I first started, I really didn't have a clue how to start it, so I went to Kimball Theater downtown and met Matthew Stevens, who's the manager down there. And I said, hey, I'm trying to start a film festival. Would you be interested? So we kind of got together over that, and it was mainly the two of us the first year. We had no idea the awesome responsibility involved in starting a film festival. This year, I think we're sitting at about 540 films that were submitted to us. Some of those, you know, may only be 5 minutes long, but some of them may be 3 hours long, too. And it's a very long process. It's basically, it's about 6-7 months of people watching films a lot. It may sound like fun and sound easy, but there's a lot more work to it than people realize. All of us who work for the film festival, we're all volunteers. We all have other jobs. So it's actually in our free time that we watch these films to select for the festival. So it's like, we're already doing that in our free time. The last thing we want to do is, oh, I got a break from this. I want to go watch more films. It's not just local films, and it's not just people, you know, Hollywood wannabes that send their films here. We get films from all over the world. We have filmmakers come in from all over the world. Past few years, we probably average about 75 filmmakers coming in to represent their films. We had an individual who came from China 2 years ago, and we actually world premiered his film because the Chinese government censored it and wouldn't allow it to be shown in public in China. So we were actually, he couldn't even show it in his own country, and we world premiered it here. It's really a great feeling when you see when filmmakers get together that have never, you know, seen each other's work, and now they have, and they start talking about it. And we've had filmmakers come in the past, they've actually met at our festival, they've lived, you know, only a few miles apart from each other, and now they've collaborated and made films together because they liked each other's work, or, you know, they said, oh, you had the best editing in that film, I'd love to be able to take advantage of that. One of the main reasons it seems that people make films is they have a story they want told, and that's what they're doing. This is their outlet to tell that story. The majority of these films will not go on to make a lot of money, and it costs a lot of money to produce a film, so a lot of them do it for the love of the film. I'm sure none of them would turn down the opportunity for a big Hollywood director role or a producer role, but, you know, a lot of them, they do it for the love of film. Although film seems like a very personal thing, or, you know, you're in a dark theater and you're quiet and everything, it's actually a very social environment. It's surprisingly social because people talk about film all the time. And although you can watch something over the internet, this is still a great way for filmmakers to get their films seen by people. And, you know, people get to get out, they get to do something. One of the reasons I got interested in film festivals is because after I attended Sundance, almost everybody's having a good time. There's people from every walk of life there. They're all talking about the one thing they like, and that's film. And it's really a great environment for something like that. And I think it's something that not only Colorado Springs needs, but a lot of other cities. And I think it's just a good social event, and it's good for the filmmakers themselves to be able to have their stuff shown.
That was Jim Turner, president of the Independent Film Society of Colorado and founder of the Indie Spirit Film Festival that will be happening in Colorado Springs this fall.
As much as we consume movies, we take for granted all the work and time and discipline that it actually takes, even to make a bad movie, even to make a sequel to some, you know, long forgotten franchise.
Sharknado.
Yeah, Sharknado takes work. And so we spoke with a novelist named Adam Mansbach, who made it big. It was a complete sort of surprise to everyone, including him. But he wrote this fake children's book. It actually started as a joke. He like put a status on Facebook like, you know, he was a new dad, and he wrote, you know, my next book is going to be called Go the F*** to Sleep. And everybody, all of his friends were like, yo, you need to write that. Like, everyone was so like, absolutely, you know. And so he, you know, he rattled out a series of rhyming couplets. Everyone loved it. It took off. And now he's in a position where Hollywood is listening to him and is interested in what he has to say. Now, of course, Hollywood is a strange beast where it'll be like, oh, you did that thing? We think that's awesome. What are you going to do for us? And then you give them 10 ideas and they say, no, 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 but we love you. and so Adam, we spoke to Adam about the art of the pitch. You know, is there an art to it? How do you go into a room of people who have access to millions and billions of funds and try to get them to
cough up the dough.
Cough up the dizzo.
The thing about pitching that's, well, all right, let me say this first. What's fascinating to me about Hollywood is that everybody in those rooms is smart. The notion that Hollywood produces stupid stuff all the time is absolutely correct. That's why there's
Madea. Hallelujah!
I like that. You guys should come to my class.
Your class?
I teach hip-hop at the center.
The center?
He's Garfield.
But it's very smart people who are making garbage movies. And they're making them because those movies make money, they run the numbers, they pre-sell it all over the world. They're clear on what they're doing. But they're smart enough to feel a little conflicted about it. They want to keep their jobs. They don't want to take risks that'll lead to them getting fired. They'd rather not take a risk and not get fired than take a risk and possibly get promoted. So there's a stasis and there's a tendency to do nothing. But everybody's really smart. So they're all looking for that one idea that is smart and gets through the tiny eye of the needle of like the smart project that can get made in Hollywood. They all want that. But you know, like I've gone into people's offices to pitch them like, you know, a relatively intelligent movie and looked around and seen like a bunch of stuffed animals all over the like sitting on the couches and like perched on top of cabinets and be like, oh, they made, you know, like the Garfield movie or whatever. And I'm like, that's who I'm talking to. And that's when you want to just leave. I guess the reason that I'm able to get in those rooms all really has to do with my obscene fake children's book, Go the F*** to Sleep.
The windows are dark in the town, child. The whales huddle down in the deep. I'll read you one very last book if you swear you'll go the F*** to sleep.
That hit the zeitgeist. Everybody was talking about it. And for some unspecified period of time thereafter, which is still going on but may end at any moment, folks in Hollywood seem to think that I might be able to do that again. You know, having success in a totally different and largely irrelevant realm still makes them want to hear what I have to say. So I was already doing screenwriting, but after Go the F*** to Sleep came out, you know, people wanted to work with me and wanted to hear what I had to say. I ended up selling a sitcom to CBS pretty quickly afterward, which was called Balls in the Air. I'm very proud of the title. It didn't get made, but I got paid to write a pilot for it. And that was a fun pitch because we kind of went in knowing that they wanted it. We had an actor attached. It had been packaged up very precisely. And the pitch was kind of like almost a formality. I've gone into other meetings with pitches that I made up in the car on the way over. I once gave a one-word pitch at, I think it was DreamWorks. And they acted like they really liked it, but I haven't written the project. It's like 3 years later. It's on the list, though. I'm going to get to it. I can't tell you what the one word is, because it's too fresh. Like, everybody listening will try to steal it. when you're pitching, what you've got to do is tell your story. Tell with confidence and illustrate evocatively the story that you want to tell. You can't try to tailor a pitch too much to what they want, because there will always be factors you're unaware of. Whether or not, you know, you sell something is more related to what they're looking for than what you're bringing. So all you can do is, like, give them what you got and understand that if you don't get it, it's because they were looking for something that had, you know, Martians in it.
Where's the kaboom? There was supposed to be an earth-shattering kaboom.
Or something that was set in the desert. Or they're looking for a vehicle for, you know, this actor, or blah, blah, blah. There's a million reasons that are unrelated to the quality of what you're pitching that nobody will care about what you're pitching. So you just, you know, you just kind of have to go in and know what your story is and be able to convey it. It's good to be funny. Unless your shit is not a comedy, in which case, if people are laughing, you might be a buster. One thing that I've found is that Hollywood seems to respect anybody who is outside of it. Like, it's a very insular world, and if they feel like you have a creative drive, passion, interest, career outside of movies, they respect that, because you aren't as beholden to their approval as 95% of the people they see. So, like, the fact that I'm a novelist and the fact that I don't live in LA, these are signifiers that weirdly give me some kind of power in the room. Like, not that Hollywood loves novelists. Hollywood has a love-hate relationship with novelists. Novelists are harder to control. They have all kinds of fancy ideas about stories, blah, blah, blah. But the one quote about screenwriting that I can remember is something that William Goldman, who's a great screenwriter, said, and it was, if you're truly a writer, like if you're a real writer, like that's what you do and it's the only thing you want to do and you're passionate and you're good and it's your career, don't ever only write screenplays. He said, you'll always be miserable if you only write screenplays, because you'll never have any control over the product ultimately. An army, an array of people will put their mitts all over it, and you may end up looking at something on the screen, if you're lucky enough to get to the screen, that you hate or don't recognize. He was like, do something else. Doesn't even matter what. Write novels, write haiku, write graffiti on bathroom walls. But if you are a writer for real, don't just write screenplays or you'll be miserable. And when I'm in there pitching, like, it's an extremely fun way to spend a couple of days. I get into it. I like performing. I like this sort of adrenaline and the you know, dog and pony show of going in and doing that thing. But if I had to do that every week, like if my life was I was a screenwriter living in LA and every couple weeks I made the rounds and had general meetings or I pitched some idea I'd come up with and I just had to do that month in and month out, I'd be miserable.
That was novelist, screenwriter, and pitchmaster extraordinaire Adam Mansbach. This is Off Topic. Stay with us.
Welcome back to Off Topic. I'm Kathy Jaffray.
I'm Steve Hayward.
And this is Idris Goodwin.
We're talking about movies, or are we talking about film?
What is the difference?
You know, it seems to me that there's going to the movies, and then there's going to the cinema to see a film.
I saw this wonderful film last week. Or were you saying, yeah, we saw this movie.
Yeah. What do you want to do? Oh, let's catch a movie. Or there's a terrific film play. I mean, I don't know. How do you tell the difference?
I'm a bit murky. Confessedly, a little bit murky. I think a film is the kind of cultural product that confuses and frustrates you in some kind of way. Is that right? And a movie is the thing that hands it over. Is that...
I think that's a pretty fair distinction. What was really interesting about the 90s, about the indie boom, the era, was that what you were seeing was these films that had the conceits of art films, but you could understand what was happening. You know, right. there was a beginning, yeah, and there were these weird hybrids.
And I think that's a really important point, that this clear distinction between the art film or the experimental film and mainstream storytelling is not as clear-cut as we think it is. So we talked to Professor Ryan Platt from the Theater and Dance Department at Colorado College about the earliest days of cinema and about how those two different streams, the experimental and the mainstream, really fed off and influenced each other, starting 100 years ago. Let's start by talking about when this thing called film or cinema started.
You know, really 17th century, Baroque, magic lanterns was a way of having a candle, and then you have a series of slides, and the slides pass one by one with a kind of rudimentary machine, and that is, in essence, cinema. Mm-hmm. But then in the later half of the 19th century, people start to tinker with them as potentially scientific inventions. And this is, you know, circa the time of the invention of photography. So we're talking photography, say 1830s, 1840s, 1850s. And cinema shortly thereafter begins to develop in reaction to the birth of photography, but then also because people are inventing really new ways of seeing. And these new ways of seeing are highly connected to new technologies, really, mm-hmm, that you have the advent of mass industrialization and the move from a principally agricultural to industrial economies, and the invention of these devices is part and parcel of that cultural development.
Right. So it seems that this is happening simultaneously with the birth of modernism.
Yep.
And industrialization as, mm-hmm, well. And it really is tied to technology.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And technology being an entire social apparatus rather than just the device itself. So when you look at early Edison films, for instance. I mean, Edison's in it for the money. He wants to create something that he can sell at sideshow carnivals originally. So he creates these devices that you look down into. His first films, you look down. It's a sort of a box, and you literally put the money into the box and you pull some lever and you look into a hole in the top of the box and you see a very, very short rudimentary film. And we're now into the 1890s. And these short films are, the first time I saw them, you're really poised for something, it's incredibly special. And then there are pictures of like chickens fighting and dancing girls, of a man boxing, of people kissing. They're spectacular attractions and they're cheap, lowbrow culture. And there's no narrative, which is, I think, really important. And the first time that there's this famous moment in the history of early film when one looks and says, okay, when did film become an art form and not just these kind of crazy sideshow doodles? And people usually look at somewhere like after the Lumiere brothers, which are sort of, they're more serious in what they're doing, that they're actually filming people. There's a famous, one of the first films is considered the Lumiere brothers, workers coming out of a factory, and I think that's 1894. And shortly thereafter, Georges Méliès, who makes these also very fantastical films. I mean, you may have seen, there have been recreations of them recently, like Voyage to la Lune. Mm-hmm. They would play music and they have these kind of crazy, cheesy visuals. And they're wonderfully cheesy, but they have a story. Mm-hmm. Even though they still have this kind of attractive element. And suddenly they have a story. And the classic narrative of cinema is that at this moment, with the Lumiere brothers, you've got narrative and then you've got, well, the movies, such as we know them today, beginning.
So I think about, you know, when my kids this summer are Todd and they're going someplace, they're going to the movies and they're going to, yeah, see something that's quite disposable, something that might be okay, yeah, might be not okay, but it's playing at the big cinemas,
yeah,
and then it's done with and it's over with. And the next weekend they'll go see something that is pretty much artistically interchangeable with it, a small amount of story and then car chase, and then, yeah, a small amount of story and then something explodes. And that seems to be to have a tension with what I consider to be film, which is not about small amount of story explosion. That those things seem to be in opposition to each other, and that the industry tell me how the movie industry fits into this opposition between art and disposable pop culture.
Well, this is a huge, huge, I think, ongoing topic of discussion. And this is a question, I think, a larger question when you sort of invoked modernism. Yes, this bifurcation between high and low culture, entertainment and art is part and parcel of modernism. And I think that the approach that I've been taking here is really to question that rather than try to aggravate or work on that tension. That tension is there. And students and viewers will pick up on it very easily. And it can become a flashpoint for lots of different cultural investments and social investments on the parts of students and viewers. Mm-hmm. So what I really try and think about is actually I like to use the words mainstream and experimental, because there's a sense that, you know, the mainstream is what runs through the middle, literally, and then the experimental is what's on the perimeter. And that these actually, it seems like they're completely opposed. But A, I would say you can't have one without the other, that the history of experimental cinema has been developed in reaction to the mainstream, and more so than we think. That this is the part I really want to get to students, is that the mainstream also appropriates from the experimental. Mm-hmm. And that there was, until the 1960s, a sort of direct battle that that they're always very surprised. And this is something that worries me about the young people of today, is that they've given up the possibility of real resistance. But they have. They don't. They're shocked when they think about when you really put it in, you know, in sort of very raw, direct terms, that the early avant-garde, especially of the 20s, 30s, 40s, you know, was basically looking to change the consciousness of their viewers, that they wanted to radically dismantle mainstream cinema such as it was. And that's completely foreign to them. But I think that there's generally been a move away from that, especially after 1970 or 1968 really being the key year. So some examples that I think of this would be that a number of the filmmakers that we look at actually make commercials. And there's a kind of history of, especially 1980 afterwards, MTV became a big forum for aspiring independent, and I should really say experimental filmmakers to have their work exposed to a larger group of people and really make some money.
Can you, once you get successful, can you still maintain, and big suits with money start coming in, can you still maintain that artistic freedom that you had when no one cared what you were doing?
Okay, so I can speak to this, but in a very speculative way, because I actually am not on the ground and I'm not a filmmaker and don't go to LA and don't know the biz. but feel like my own affiliations come from rough underground 60s DIY culture,
mm-hmm.
Which is in some ways, as I sort of mentioned in passing earlier, always constructed itself in direct opposition to large mainstream culture, especially Hollywood. That's the devil. And I think that that's actually become less in the sort of, especially 1980 afterwards, that's become less the driving focus of that work. And there's much more, I think, consciousness of a kind of, reciprocity and complicity between the mainstream and the experimental. That said, can you keep up your artistic integrity? I just put that in scare quotes. For who has integrity today? I mean, really, it's just, you know, we're constantly being broke down by various structures. So the idea of integrity, I think I went to a conference recently and ended up just talking. Someone kept pushing one of the leaders of it kept pushing impure. She's like, we have to talk about the impure. It seems that this is a good impure moment. So if you want to keep up your pure ambitions, I'd question whether they could even be there in the first place, because that's actually predicating this idea that there is something that's entertainment and there is something that's art, and that art doesn't have anything to do with money. And entertainment has everything to do with money, when actually I think it's there's a little bit of truth to that, but and there's always money. There's always money involved, and especially in art. I mean, art is, I mean, right now it's become, you know, in the visual arts, pure commodity. And right. Film occupies actually a kind of interesting, difficult place in that world of pure commodity.
That was Professor Ryan Platt from the Theater and Dance Department at Colorado College.
This is Idris Goodwin.
I'm Steve Hayward.
And I'm Kathy Jaffray. We've been talking about movies in the summertime.
Thank you for being part of the Off Topic family this week, Idris.
Listen, anytime you guys want to talk about movies, even in the winter, in the spring, whenever, I'm game. I'm game.
Well, come back and join us again, all right?
Great. True pleasure.
Saturday night at 8 o'clock, I know where I'm going to go. I'm going to pick my baby up and take her to the picture show. Everybody in the neighborhood is dressing up to be there too.
Off Topic is produced by Craig Richardson and Jake Brownell, with help from the Tim Gill Center for Public Media, a part of Rocky Mountain PBS, in association with Colorado College and KRCC in Colorado Springs.
You can find us at www.offtopicradio.org. I'm Steve Hayward.
I'm Kathy Jaffray.
And until next week, stay off topic.
From the candy stand, makes it all seem twice as good. There's always lots of pretty.